This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the October 25th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. In a recent past program, I suggested that the launching of the Iraq War has proved to be, in geopolitical terms, the greatest disaster in modern U.S. history. It doesn't make me unusually wise, since it's an opinion shared with a number of pundits and military experts. But I also pointed out that it has been arguably far more catastrophic for the peoples of the Middle East, of North and Sub-Saharan Africa, and accelerated by the Obama administration's major role in the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, the United States deserves a major share of the blame for the world's greatest refugee crisis since the Second World War. This not surprisingly awakened the latent racism and xenophobia in the countries of Western and Central Europe, as tens of thousands of men, women, and children fleeing the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria arrived at their borders and, after the fall of Libya, were joined by thousands of others from North and Sub-Saharan Africa. One outcome of this has been the rise in relative success in the polls of neo-Nazi-based parties, most recently in Germany and Austria. Relatively few of the refugees have been allowed to settle in the United States, and the Trump administration has made sure it will stay that way. And what do most Americans think about their country's role in all this? The answer would seem is they don't think about it at all. In Notes on a Foreign Country, an American Abroad in a Post-American World, Istanbul-based journalist Susie Hansen writes that, quote, "We cannot go abroad today as Americans in the 21st century and not realize that the main thing that has been terrorizing us is our own ignorance, our blindness and subsequent discovery of all the people on whom the empire that was not an empire had been constructed without our attention and concern. Americans," she notes, "were in active denial of their empire even as they laid its foundations," end quote. Those are insights of journalist Susie Hansen. I'll be speaking with her in Istanbul at 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned. For further evidence of the current extent of the American empire, we can begin by asking the right questions about the death of four U.S. soldiers in Niger, killed in an ambush 2 weeks ago, along with five of their Nigerian counterparts. You can't have missed it, the insulting comment from resident Rump to the wife of one of them, a young black American Green Beret from Florida, Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, that has now led to congressional hearings on the event. "He knew what he was signing up for, but when it happens, it hurts anyway," Trump told the pregnant widow, Maisha, on her cell phone with a speaker on as she was riding in a car with her congresswoman and personal friend, Frederica Nelson. But did Johnson really know what he was doing there? Do we know why the U.S. military is in Niger, a mineral-rich former French colony twice the size of Texas? Perhaps the fact that it is mineral-rich and the world's fourth leading source of uranium answers the question, but according to the website of the U.S. Africa Command, and what does that name tell you? "A stable, safe, and secure and prosperous Africa is an enduring U.S. interest. Niger is an important partner to the U.S. The United States and Niger have a long-standing bilateral relationship. Who knew? Our militaries have been stalwart allies," it goes on, "focused on working together to deter and defeat terrorist threats of the West African nation and across the Sahel region. The U.S. military does not have an active direct combat in Niger," the website tells us. "AFRICOM provides training and security assistance to the Nigerian armed forces, includes support for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance to facilitate their efforts to target violent extremist organizations in the region. This training includes advising and assisting Nigerians to increase their organic ability to bring stability and security to their country," end quote. I need to stop there and say that whatever instability exists in Niger, whatever violence has come to its citizens from extremist organizations, can be traced to the abundance of weapons that became available for looting following the U.S., or more precisely, the Hillary Clinton-led overthrow and disemboweling of Colonel Gaddafi. According to the website, there are approximately 800 U.S. military personnel in Niger and over 6,000 troops on the African continent overall. They include members of the 724th Expeditionary Airbase Squadron, or EABS, who were the 31st Expeditionary Red Horse Squadron, and members of the military police and Navy Seabees are building Airbase 201, which, ironically, according to a BBC documentary made last year, is a starting point for the trek of sub-Saharan refugees toward Europe. It is projected to be the biggest project created by military labor in Air Force history. We're in the early stages right now of establishing a presence in the area, but one day this once empty desert will be a fully functioning flight line, said an Air Force spokesperson. AFRICOM is one of the U.S. Armed Forces' 9 combatant commands that cover the entire globe. According to its website, it is responsible for military operations, including fighting regional conflicts and military relations with 53 African nations. Its area of responsibility is all of Africa except Egypt, which is within the area of responsibility for the Central Command, or CENTCOM. So much for U.S. respect for the sovereignty of these nations. It doesn't exist. As the late Phil Oakes wrote a half century ago, we're the cops of the world. President George Bush authorized the creation of the Africa Command in December 2006, but the public wasn't told about it, and then not very much in February 2007. Headquartered at the Kelly Army Base in Stuttgart, Germany, it became operational a month before the 2008 presidential election. Ironically or deliberately, it was left to an African-American president to put it into action, but without letting Congress or the American people in on the extent of it. In a speech in Accra, Ghana, in July 2009, Obama declared, quote, America has a responsibility to advance this vision not just with words, but with support that strengthens African capacity. When there is genocide in Darfur or terrorists in Somalia, these are not simply African problems. They are global security challenges, and they demand a global response. That is why we stand ready to partner through diplomacy, technical assistance, and logistical support, and will stand behind efforts to hold war criminals accountable. Our African command is focused not on establishing a foothold in the continent, Obama went on, but on confronting these common challenges to advance the security of America, Africa, and the world, end quote. Sorry, Mr. Obama, but the record says otherwise. You had not only the opportunity, but the duty to try the war criminals who started the Iraq War, and you not only refused to do that, but became arguably a war criminal yourself while expanding the footprint of the American empire. The undisguised arrogance of that empire has been on full display with the election of Donald Trump, and in no instance more so than in his attempt to abrogate the deal the Obama administration jointly made with his fellow UN Security Council members, plus Germany, with Iran, that is Tehran rolling back and freezing its nuclear enrichment program for the next decade. His decision 2 weeks ago not to recertify the agreement from Washington's standpoint, met with the approval of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, its lobby, and Saudi Arabia, but disappointed all of America's Western allies. In a vituperative speech a week ago Friday, Trump threatened to terminate U.S. participation in the deal if Congress and those allies failed to amend the agreement in significant ways, which Iran has no interest in doing, such as curtailing Iran's missile program and other aspects of its sovereignty. Trump stopped short of immediately canceling U.S. participation in the deal, but made it clear that unless a restriction on Iran's nuclear program is made permanent, and if those negotiations fail to reach a solution, which is almost certain, he would unilaterally pull the U.S. out of the international agreement. Thanks to pressure from AIPAC, Congress voters require the president to certify Iran's compliance with the terms of the deal every 90 days, regardless of the opinion of the International Atomic Energy Agency charged with the monitoring of it. Lobbied heavily by AIPAC, the House is expected to vote this week on new sanctions on Iran's ballistic missile program and on Lebanon's Iran-backed Hezbollah militia. It is Congress's responsibility to work with the executive branch on a clear-eyed strategy to stop Iran's reckless behavior, Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, the number 2 House Republican, and Representative Ed Royce, chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, said in a joint statement emailed to Reuters. Immediate action toward this goal will come from the House next week as we vote on legislation that further sanctions Hezbollah and Iran's missile proliferation, they said. In the Senate, a separate effort is underway to amend existing U.S. law to set new conditions for Washington's role in the pact, although such a plan could violate terms of the deal formerly known as the JCPOA. The ballistic missile bill would toughen existing sanctions by going after entities with assets outside the United States, in other words, secondary sanctions, if they were found to support Iran's ballistic missile program. It supposedly has broad bipartisan support in the House and also is expected to pass the Senate. The Hezbollah bill is directed at the Shia militia's Maronite Christian allies in Lebanon's government, and according to Reuters, it asked the Trump administration to estimate and distribute assessments of the net worth of these Lebanese politicians, which on the face of it is none of America's business, but seems to be consistent with our sense of empire. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson warned Europeans on Sunday not to invest in certain Iranian businesses while the Trump administration is considering walking away from the Iran nuclear deal and reimposing sanctions against Iran. Speaking at a news conference in Riyadh, the Saudi capital, with the Saudi foreign minister Abdel Al-Jabir, Tillerson said, "Both of our countries believe that those who conduct business with the Iranian Revolutionary Guards and any other entities, European companies or other companies around the globe, really do so at great risk." End quote. European diplomats have said they would defend their companies against such sanctions, potentially setting up an epic battle between close allies and two of the largest commercial markets on the planet. At the same press conference, Tillerson, speaking for the empire, demanded that Iranian militias leave Iraq. "Certainly Iranian militias that are in Iraq," he said, "now that the fighting against the Islamic State is coming to a close, those militias need to go home." And an unparalleled display of chutzpah, he added, "All foreign fighters need to go home," end quote. Presumably those of our empire are not considered foreign by the Secretary of State. There are thought to be as many as 120,000 fighters who belong to the Popular Mobilization Units, or PMUs, in Iraq, volunteer fighting groups comprised of previously existing organizations that came together after a call by Iraqi religious leader Ali al-Sistani in 2014 to protect Iraq from ISIS. Although they are largely paid by the government in Iraq and Baghdad, the most established groups are accused by their critics of being loyal to Iran and to have engaged in sectarian reprisals against Sunnis. Tillerson's Gulf visit was part of Washington's ongoing efforts to curb Iran's influence in the region, including boosting the clout of Sunni-ruled Saudi Arabia and Iraq, while Iran backs Shia militias fighting ISIS. So far, it doesn't seem to be working. On May 2nd, coming back home, what Israel considers its Independence Day, Texas State Republican Representative Phil King stood smiling as Governor Greg Abbott signed King's bill banning the state from doing business with boycotters of Israel. "Anti-Israel policies are anti-Texas policies, and we will not tolerate such actions against an important ally," Abbott said of the bill that overwhelmingly passed the Texas legislature. Less than 6 months later, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency reports King had to explain why his signature pro-Israel policy was not an anti-Texas policy. City officials in Dickinson, a suburb of Houston hard hit by Hurricane Harvey, required any applicant for relief grants to verify that he or she, one, does not boycott Israel, and two, will not boycott Israel during the term of this agreement, end quote. The American Civil Liberties Union took notice and loudly objected. Observers noted the queasy-making optics of a pro-Israel policy standing in the way of hurricane relief. King, a Republican whose district includes Fort Worth, immediately started making calls to track down the Dickinson officials who drafted the contract. "It's a complete misunderstanding of the statute," he said in an interview, after what had been for him a surprisingly busy Friday after the ACLU's objections made news. The office of Larry Taylor, a Republican who sponsored the law in the state Senate and whose district includes Dickinson, also was fielding questions about the law on Friday. "If Dickinson is indeed misunderstanding the law," noted the Jewish Telegraphic Agency report, "the case nevertheless brought to the fore misgivings about the measures passed in more than 20 states targeting the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement aimed at Israel. Critics say they may impinge on free speech rights and create a backlash by making it seem the government is using the law to suppress one side in a political debate." Well, that's what they're doing, actually. Anyway, a federal law prohibiting compliance with or support for boycott of Israel, which I've reported on before, is facing stumbling blocks. Opponents of the law say the Dickinson case and one in Kansas, where a teacher trainer who supports a boycott of Israel is refusing to sign a state contract that includes an anti-boycott clause, prove their point. In addition to being mystifying, what do home repairs in Texas have to do with a country more than 7,000 miles away? This requirement is clearly unconstitutional, Brian House, an ACLU staff attorney, wrote in a blog post. The ACLU, which says it takes no position on boycotts per se, is leading a campaign to stem the tide of anti-BDS laws. The First Amendment, quote, protects the right of Americans to participate in political boycotts, a right explicitly recognized by the Supreme Court in a case that concerned an NAACP-organized boycott to protest white supremacy in Port Gibson, Mississippi, wrote Haas. The controversies over Dickinson and the Kansas case come at a critical time for a congressional bill that would extend 1970 laws targeting the Arab League boycott to those who comply with boycotts initiated by an international organization, including the European Union and the United Nations. The Israel Anti-Boycott Act, backed by AIPAC, also would expand the prohibited boycotts to those that target only goods produced on Jewish settlements that the U.S. government has in the past considered to be illegal. Violators who participate in boycotts would face fines and, in some cases, imprisonment up to 20 years. AIPAC wanted broad bipartisan backing for the bill, but only 14 of the Democratic caucus's 48 members are co-sponsoring legislation, reflecting perhaps the increasing distaste for Israel among younger party activists. Notably, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, who in the past has assiduously courted the pro-Israel community, dropped her co-sponsorship after meeting with the ACLU and pro-Palestinian activists, which led her to be immediately targeted by Israel firsters and New York's Jewish community. What we have been seeing here is a ham-handed effort by Israel and its U.S. backers to force Americans, in effect, to swear their loyalty to Israel. It's high time the public woke up and stopped this attempt to subvert what remains of our civil liberties and turn those politicians who support it out of office. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.